Week. Today is Tuesday, April 12, 2005. We have Robin Lamont, our LFO analyst, subcommittee scheduler, and Kat Bell, our subcommittee assistant. Today we're going to have a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5014, Department of Consumer Business Services Budget Bill. And I think we're also going to be talking about the Department of Consumer Business Service Fee Bill, House Bill 5015. Why don't we ask, let's see who, we want to have Corey, Greg, and Satish come on up, and let's go through this. Now, how many days are...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually, we have 2 days for this overview.
Okay.
And I did want to point out, I have handed out the agenda for the meeting that you scheduled for tomorrow.
Okay.
Tomorrow, the subcommittee will have an informational meeting involving the Oregon small business related to Small Business Day at the Capitol. So I wanted folks to be aware of the tentative agenda for that meeting tomorrow as well. And then we will pick up with our public hearing. I doubt that we will go to work session, but our public hearing on the Department of Consumer and Business Services budget and fee bills on Thursday.
Perfect.
And I had handed out to all of you a brief overview of, I sent it out with a yellow cover on it, the LFO overview of the Consumer and Business Services Phase 2 material. I'm not going to go through it today. Basically, what I will do is wait and make sure that everything gets covered and then wrap up at the very end of the presentation on Thursday.
Perfect.
So if any members don't have a copy of what I distributed, let me know. We've got extra copies.
Robin, I don't think I have it.
Thank you. I apologize.
Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
What I would share with the committee is, as Robin was saying, we have 2 days. What we'll try and do is find a balance between receiving information and asking questions. At some point, if it looks like we're going to be lagging too far behind, I might ask that we hold our questions and proceed forward. But other than that, we will move forward. So, welcome. Why don't we begin? Hi, Satish.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyaya with the Department of Administrative Services, and today I will be providing you with an overview of the Governor's Budget for the Department of Consumer and Business Services for 2005-2007 biennium. And if you all will refer to the presentation handout that has been passed, it looks like this. If you will turn to page 2. Now, you've seen the charts in this page a number of times. And the charts here show the budget for the entire consumer and business services program area. And this program area consists of 17 state agencies, including the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The governor's recommended budget for the consumer and business services program area consists of $840.1 million of total funds. This is about 2% of the total state budget. And this program has $11.6 million of general fund, and that's just for one state agency, which is the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The rest of the agencies are mostly funded with fees and assessments. One thing to note on these charts is that the DCBS budget is 74% of the total program area budget. So this definitely is the largest state agency under this program. Moving along to page 3, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, its functions focus on protecting consumers and workers while promoting a positive business climate in the state. These functions support 3 out of the 6 of the governor's budget principles, and the principles that this agency's functions support are those relating to health and basic needs, public safety, and economic development. Moving along to page 4, the chart there shows the various fund types that make up this agency's budget. As you can see, the governor's recommended budget consists of $621.9 million of total funds. The thing to note here is that 71% of the budget consists of non-limited other funds. Out of the non-limited other funds, 54% is for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, payment of claims for parties covered under the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool policies. Now, this program, also known as the OMIP program, provides access to health care coverage for Oregonians who are unable to get coverage on their own. And this could be because of bad health conditions or change or loss of jobs. And 45% of the non-limited budget is for payments out of the workers' benefit fund. Now, payments are made out of this fund, as it was mentioned during phase one, for certain workers' comp claims costs, for premium subsidies, as well as for return-to-work incentives. Moving along to page five, here, the chart there shows the various program units that make up this agency. There are 12 program units. So this definitely is a large agency. And again, the thing to note here is the Workers' Benefit Fund and the OMIP program, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Program, consists of 71% of the budget. And Central Support Services, which provides administrative support and leadership to the entire agency, it's about 5% of the total budget. Moving along to page 6. The chart here shows the various budget categories. 23% of the budget consists of personal services. These are costs relating to total employee compensation. And 7% of the budget is for services and supplies. And less than 1% is for capital outlay. And the major, again, 70% of the budget is for special payments. Moving on to page 7. The table here shows the does a comparison of the budget for this agency between several biennia. So if you look at the column on the far right, the governor's budget, of course, is $621.9 million total funds. This is a little over 11% increase from the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget. This includes $179.4 million of limited other funds. This is a 3.5% increase from the 2003-2005 budget. And all of this increase is in personal services. The budget also includes $442.5 million of non-limited other funds. This is a 14.5% increase from 2003-2005. And this increase is almost entirely due to the increase in enrollment in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Program. Moving along to page 8, the major policy issues. The governor's budget recognizes the important role played by this agency in protecting consumers and workers while also promoting a positive business climate in the state. It continues all existing programs. There's increase in non-limited expenditures due to increase in enrollment under the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Program. And under the limited budget, there are no significant enhancements in this budget. Basically, there's a package under for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, where there's an abolishment of 10 full-time equivalent positions, and then there's also a restoration of these positions pending legislative approval of the fee bill that you will be seeing today or tomorrow or Thursday. The agency has requested a technical adjustment on reducing the abolishment and restoration of the positions to 7 positions based on a new projection, and we're supporting that. So instead of 10, it's going to be 7 positions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I should perhaps know the answer to this, Satish, but I just don't, or I've forgotten. The increase of overall enrollment in the Oregon Medical Insurance Plan, and maybe you're the wrong person to ask, what's driving that?
Madam Chair, Senator Johnson, I think Director Strygens may be in a position to answer that better.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, a couple of things. First of all, of course, we do have an increasing number of uninsured in Oregon, and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is one source of insurance for that segment of the people who would be otherwise uninsured who are excluded from the ability to purchase insurance because of their health condition. So there are obviously more potential customers as insurance is unavailable for other reasons. What happened, though, year to year and a half ago is the enrollment in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool flattened and actually for the first time started to drop, not because of a lack of need, because the need was very definitely there, but because of price. As with health insurance, I'm sure all of you have heard from your constituents, and you know that the cost of health insurance is going up, and it was going up proportionally in OMIP to the point where it was not affordable. So the OMIP board actually did a benefit redesign to offer some lower cost options. And that has resulted in significant in the trend line going back to the growth line. It serves a need.
And at what point is the Oregon medical insurance pool capped at some point or open-ended as far as subscribers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it is open-ended. But the difference between the cost of payment of the claims, which is covered by premium, and the cost of the full cost of those claims is an assessment against insurers. And the insurers sit on the board and vote the assessment. So the control mechanism is the insurance industry's tolerance for assessment.
Thank you very much for that tutorial. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, one thing you'll be seeing in this budget is that there's a reduction in positions. In comparison to 2003-2005, there's a reduction of 16.53 full-time equivalent positions. This includes 6.3 full-time equivalent positions in the building codes division due to revenue shortfalls. And also another thing in this budget is you'll
Really quick, what are the other positions? You mentioned three of the 16.
And Mr. Chair, I mentioned 6.3 out of the 16, and there are position reductions in different divisions. I think in the LFO memo on the last page, you can see a listing of the positions. There's reductions. There's 3.83 FTE reduction in Oregon OSHA. There's 0.5 FTE. Let's see. There's 0.96 FTE reduction in central support. There's one position reduction in the insurance division, and there's also, and those are the main ones. And there's a 5.5 positions reductions in the workers' compensation division, and we would be happy to provide you with a list by division if that's what you want.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, another thing you'll see in this budget is that there's a reduction in the generic services and supplies budget. In the governor's recommended budget, there's been a reduction of close to $2.8 million based on the agency's expenditure patterns. Moving along to the last page, you will be presented the fee bill, House Bill 50.
Satish, I'm looking at the agency summary on personnel. Let's go through these positions really quick here. You folks should have the 05-07 being proposed. Explain to me the change in positions in the building codes division. I see that the 03-05 legislatively adopted budget allocated 157 positions.
Building codes division, yes, sir. Mr. Chair, the 03-05 legislatively approved budget allocated 150.74 full-time equivalent positions. Is that the number you have?
For members that are interested in looking at this, the comparison is under the agency overview tab, page 1.
Okay, so we were 157, we're now down to 148.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Where did those savings go? What did we do with those dollars?
Mr. Chair, you will see a reduction package in the building codes division. There's a reduction of 6.3 positions and a reduction of the budget by $856,953 in the building codes division. Now, these positions were reduced as a result of a revenue shortfall.
6.3 makes it 139.
That doesn't add up.
143.75 plus 6.3 brings you over to 149, a little over 149, it says 148.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there is also a reduction. You may want to refer under the agency's budget by document one. Document I always find helpful is the summary of the 0305 or 0507 budget. This really
why don't we do this so we can keep proceeding forward? Why don't you take the 0305 approved and the 0507 and just be prepared to come back tomorrow and show us where the changes are in each of the areas?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we'll do that.
The pluses or the minuses?
Yes, we will do that.
Perfect.
And you'd like that by division?
Please.
Yes, we'll have that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Moving along, the last page, there will be a fee bill where you'll be which requests a ratification of the fees that were administratively established or increased during 2003-2005, and this involves three divisions: the Building Codes Division, the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and the Workers' Compensation Division. Okay. Lastly, there's a technical adjustment which I talked to you earlier. This relates to the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. In the Governor's recommended budget, there's a reduction of 10 positions and a restoration of 10 positions. Now we are requesting a technical adjustment to reduce that number of positions to seven positions based on a new revenue forecast.
Thank you.
And that's it, Mr. Chair, unless you have any questions.
Senator Berger.
I'd like for you to go back to the fee and revenue issue on page 9. You're requesting ratification of fees that were established or increased during 0305, and why would they be ratified again? It's only for every session we go back and address that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, there's a bill called Senate Bill 333, and it establishes a process which is frankly pretty confusing. That means if there's a fee increase or establishment that's done administratively during the interim, then the next legislature has to ratify those fees. So the fees can be increased or established administratively without legislative approval. But okay, we have to come back during session and get your ratification.
All right. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
All right. And who does that during the interim? The department?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the department proposes that, and it comes to the Department of Administrative Services, and the director of the Department of Administrative Services has the authority to approve those.
Okay, so just, Mr. Chair, just so that I understand the process here, during the interim, the department goes to DAS, asks for these increases, DAS approves it, and it comes to the legislature for ratification.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Richardson.
Do you have any intention to impose any fee increases in the next 2 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, not at this point, but one reason for the mechanism which Mr. Padier described is because it is very difficult to predict 24 months ahead. So the agency does have the ability to adjust fees during the interim subject to legislative ratification. My goal is never to raise fees, and in fact, we tend to be to set a very high standard internally before we consider a fee increase. When we do believe that a fee increase needs to be considered, it's done through a formal rulemaking process with stakeholder input, and we generally would move forward with a fee increase only if stakeholders support it. Again, I can't predict exactly what the next 2 years would bring.
Follow up, please.
My concern is, of course, is when you implement a fee and then come to the legislature 2 years later and say, oh, by the way, we've done this and we just want you to ratify it, it's a whole lot easier to get ratification for something that's already been done than it is to ask for approval. And so that's why I was asking, do you have any intention? Because, I mean, I know you can't know the future, but I'd just like to know if there's anything in the works now so that we could flesh that out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, actually one of the fees that's in the fee bill we have not implemented yet, specifically because we wanted to be able to have the legislative conversation first, and we could do it in terms of timing, and that is on the worker leasing program. So when we can, we would rather not be in the situation that you describe. But we regard our obligation as to not to regard it as a fait accompli, but instead to give you an honest assessment of what the program would look like if the fee increase is rolled back, and then it's a choice. We don't want to put you in the position of saying, well, we've done it, and now you have to say yes. It's our obligation to manage a program that is scaled to whatever level of fee you instruct us to go forward with.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Carter.
usually departments don't want the wrath, Representative Richardson, of the legislature. So what they do is each of the departments have advisory committees and boards and that kind of stuff, and they work in tandem with those advisory committee of their board, who are people who have special interest in that department. Mm-hmm. So along with them, they make the decision to bring it to the legislature. And sometimes, on rare occasions, have I seen a department come in that said, our advisory committee said in order for this program to maintain its efficacy, we needed to raise the fees, and now what we want you to do is ratify it. Not because we wanted it, because the external forces to us wanted to see it happen in order to have smoothness in the department.
Thank you. How do you want to proceed?
Well, Mr. Chair, and for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which I should have said several questions ago. And with me is Greg Malkasian, the Deputy Director of the Department. And we know your time is very short, and we've also been in front of this committee twice before, and I'm conscious of using your time well, and I don't want to repeat information which you've heard already. What I thought might be the most useful to you is if we go through at an overview level our department's programs with a particular emphasis on areas that raised questions and concerns during our prior two appearances. And so that, if that suits the committee, that would be my goal today. And then we would be back on Thursday for any additional issues that have come up, anything we don't get to today, and then also a presentation of the fee bill and public testimony, as I understand it. And I want to mention some additional materials that we have provided you with, which should be in front of you, and they are tabbed so that if you have the notebook that we put together for Phase 1, you can put it in the back of the notebook, and it should have should be in two sections, a tab G and a tab H. Tab G is an additional copy of each of the letters that we sent during Phase 1 responding to questions. And as I go through the presentation today, I'm probably going to be drawing your attention to some of that material and then as we get to the specific areas. Tab H is also material that I'll get to go through that responds to some questions, but the material in Tab H has not been sent to you previously. And one area that we address a fair amount in those materials because of your prior questions and that I want to spend a fair amount of time on today is how the department's services are provided to small business, because that's obviously a great concern to you. It's obviously a great concern to us as well. So I'll be touching on that as we go through. And as you know, our mission is to protect consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in Oregon. We are the largest business regulatory and consumer protection agency in the state, and as Satish mentioned, we are an other-funded agency. We receive no general fund support. Our revenues come from about 500 different fees and assessments, which are paid by those we regulate and statutorily dedicated to specific programs. And each of our programs is intended to support our three goals, which are protection of consumers and workers, regulating in a manner that supports a positive business climate, and being accountable to the public we serve with excellent customer service. We are, as you know, organized into five major divisions and a number of smaller programs, and I'd like to go through each of those areas, touch on, just remind you of the program area, touch on a few of our accomplishments, and then also, as I said, focus on some of the services that we provide to small business. And I'll start with Oregon OSHA. And the goals of Oregon OSHA, of course, are to improve workplace health and safety and reduce the incidence of workplace injuries and illnesses. And as you know, our programs in this area, we have the inspection function where we focus on high-hazard industries and industries where workers are more likely to be injured or exposed to hazardous materials. We investigate serious workplace accidents and fatalities. We provide consultation and training and technical services, and those are voluntary services at the request of businesses. And then, of course, we promulgate regulations to promote health and safety and compliance with federal standards. And in this area, We and as well as workers' compensation. Of course, our services are provided to all Oregon employers. 90% of those employers are small business with 20 employees or less. So if our programs are to be successful, they have to be shaped and structured in a way that works for small business.
How do you do that?
Well, in a number of ways, actually, and let me start with Oregon OSHA. We have, in focus groups and discussions with small businesses that use our services, one thing we hear over and over again is too much paperwork and too complex regulations. So it's not that businesses don't want to be safe and they don't want to comply, but they don't want to have to deal with this many regulations, and they don't want to have to deal with a lot of paperwork. And we have been working on both of those aspects of our regulations.
Could you share with us, how have you worked on those?
The regulations, for example, and we mentioned this before, we have just completed a core rules project that takes that shelf full of regulations and boils it down into one fairly modest set of regulations that are the basics that will essentially provide for safety compliance for any small business. That's available, and we've distributed it to small business development centers, through our resource library, to small businesses. Mr. Chair, I believe you have a copy of it. The intent is to get the rules into a very user-friendly, simple-to-understand format, not that deals with every technical issue, but that is basically usable for the vast majority of businesses in Oregon.
I'm going to hold your feet to the fire on this one. You made the comment that you've gotten it out to small businesses. How many small businesses?
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information, but I think Pete DeLuca is in the audience. You know, Pete, how many copies we've distributed thus far?
I know that we've...
Mr. Chair, my name is Peter Luther. I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA. I don't know how many we've distributed thus far exactly, but...
How many did you have printed up?
That I couldn't tell you either. I can get that information for you. We have distributed them to all the small business centers around the state.
How many are there?
Nine. Isn't that right? Or six? What?
19.
Okay. And what we did when we sent them out is we sent them out with a questionnaire for people to respond back and tell us whether they were useful and if they helped and if they didn't help or if they could be improved, how we could improve them. It's very early in our testing process. We've just released these things in the last 3 or 4 months.
I'd just be interested in knowing how many were printed and how those are being disseminated out to small businesses.
We'll be happy to get that to you. Let me give you some other examples, if I could. I mentioned the paperwork issue. And one of the requirements for many businesses, including many small businesses, if they're depending on their classification, is to work with a safety committee. And a safety committee is an employee group. For a small employer, it's all employees, because we found that's one of the best ways of promoting safety. And we prepared a publication, actually, to respond to concerns from small businesses. I don't know how to do it. It's too much paperwork. What am I supposed to do? And we brought copies for you, because the intent of this particular booklet is to have all the paperwork as boiled down and simplified as possible in a format that any employer can easily use, and just by taking a few notes in a weekly meeting can be not only in compliance with our laws regarding safety committees, but can actually use the safety committees effectively to talk about hazards and to talk about issues. So that's an example where for a business of 400 employees, this wouldn't be suitable, for a business with 10 employees, this is all you need to know and all you need to do to be in compliance and to have a safety committee work for you.
So how do you disseminate this?
There again, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to get back to you with the specifics. I know it is widely disseminated, but I can't give you exact numbers. But if I could give you some other examples, and I actually have numbers on a few of these, we do offer training that is, again, specifically designed for the needs of small business, because a small business person can't spend all day at a training course, so we have put together a series of classes that are 1 hour in length, offered either over the noon hour or early in the morning, so that a small business owner can go to a couple of one-hour classes and get the training they need, and we offer those throughout the state, often in conjunction with small business development centers. Classes in the last few years have been in Klamath Falls, Medford, Grants Pass, Milton Freewater, Pendleton, Hermiston, The Dalles, Hood River, Newburgh, Scappoose, Sutherland, Winston, Philomath, Coquiel, Sheridan, Oak Ridge, North Bend, Reedsport, Burns, Redmond, Heppner, John Day, Madras, Astoria, Tillamook, as well as the Salem and Portland areas. We also have 10 basic courses available online so that any business that has internet access can access them anytime. And those are so at your own time, at your own convenience, but the last module then includes an interactive session with one of our trainers. We offer videos, which, again, can be ordered free of charge by any business. We have shipped out about 7,500 videos during calendar year 2004. Almost 4,000 of those were outside the core Willamette Valley area, and, again, to businesses of all sizes throughout the state. But the intended audience is small business. Incidentally, we offer those in many of them in Spanish as well. And close to 700 of those Spanish-language videotapes went out. The only expense for the business is return postage. So those are some examples. We also do, as I mentioned, consultation, and that's available to any size employer. So we will go into the work site and consult on how to make that workplace safer and how to respond to the concerns of the business. For us, being effective with respect to services to small business is core to what we do. I think you're familiar with the fact that safety has improved in Oregon over the past years, and that has to mean in all sectors, not just large businesses, but small businesses as well. And, of course, this is not exclusively due to Oregon OSHA. There are many other players who help get safety information out, but we believe that the programs that we've developed in Oregon OSHA are helpful in meeting small business needs, and we are always eager to find out more suggestions about how we can make these programs accessible.
How many OSHA violations were there in the last biennium?
How many OSHA violations?
And maybe I'm not framing the question correctly. Is there a way of cataloging who's not in compliance and who is?
I think we probably, Mr. Chairman, I think we probably have that information. I don't have it at my fingertips. Let me.
There again, Mr. Chair, we can certainly get back to you on that.
Sure.
And as you know, we inspect based on a number of different factors. And so we can't tell you how many violations there may be in workplaces that we don't inspect, but we can tell you the outcomes of inspections.
The process to making sure that citizens are safe and that small business owners get the technical assistance they need in trying to bridge the two together. And so I'm trying to figure out is if the outreach is occurring to help small business owners and medium-sized and large business owners be proactive in avoiding OSHA issues. And as I listen to this, to me it seems like an indicator of success would be the number of OSHA citations that are issued.
Mr. Chair, I should say, when we do an inspection, our goal is to obviously identify critical safety issues, but our primary goal is to get them corrected and to help the business understand why there's a problem and how to correct it in the future. So a citation may or may not issue. Our goal isn't to issue a citation. Our goal is to teach about safety. What we can certainly do is provide you with numbers of inspections that we do and then also the outcomes of those inspections, if that would be helpful.
Perfect. Thank you.
If there are other questions about Oregon OSHA, again, I'm just conscious of your time. I was planning to move on to the Workers' Compensation Division. In the Workers' Compensation Division, of course, we are also very concerned with worker safety, and our goal here is to make sure that in the event that a worker is injured, first of all, we want to make sure that those businesses have workers' compensation coverage so that if a worker is injured, the coverage is there to protect them. We want to ensure that workers receive accurate and timely benefits, that they receive quality medical care, and we facilitate early return to work for injured workers. Again, getting a worker back to work quickly is one of the biggest benefits that we can offer to both the employer and to the injured worker. We handle alternative dispute resolution, and we also reimburse for retroactive and supplemental benefits from the workers' benefit fund.
How do you, when you're working with an injured worker, do you, are they, is it like a caseload for your people? How do you work with an injured worker to get them back to work?
We have several different programs, some of which are available through the employer. But one of the bills that we have in front of the legislature this session will actually allow us to make benefits directly available to the worker. So a worker, for example, in the preferred worker program can market themselves as a preferred worker. And what the some of the benefits that are available would include job site modifications, the ability for an employer to actually get that workers' compensation coverage paid, so that if they are worried about the worker being re-injured, they get a financial benefit for hiring that worker. So we work through the employers, and then also the workers' compensation. When the workers' claim is processed, they receive information through the workers' compensation insurer about these different programs. We are spending quite a bit of effort right now trying to improve the usefulness of the injured work of the return to work programs, because we do see such benefit in what they deliver.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Corey, I'm looking at surveys.
Yes.
Relating to workers' comp. And one of them is asking a group of adjusters how satisfied they are with the services of having DCBS provide claim file requests. Would you explain what that is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm not sure that I can explain what that is, but we can certainly get back to you on that. That's a level of detail that I'm sorry I just do not have with me.
You have somebody there who's familiar with what that we know what a claim file request is? That's a pretty, I mean, are we talking about, does DCBS maintain claim files on all workers and then provide those files of history of claims to insurance adjusters?
Mr. Chair, we do maintain claim files, but what that specific issue is and what that specific survey response is about, I don't know, but we can certainly answer it before the end of today's hearing. Okay. We don't have the Workers' Compensation Division in the room, but they are listening back at the office, and I'm sure they will be here within a matter of moments.
Follow up.
At least they will now.
My follow-up claim, assuming that the answer is what I expected, is are you also providing a copy of that file to the claimant, to the worker, since that would only be fair if the department is providing the claims history to insurance adjusters?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, again, if you don't mind, I would like to defer that question until John Schultz or Jerry Manhan is in the room, because they are the real experts. Okay. And I know that access to claims files by injured workers is a hot topic. I don't want to misspeak.
Okay, that's fine. I'll hold it. Thanks.
So share with me, I'm an injured worker. How do you get me back to work?
Again, what I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is if I could, since we have the Workers' Compensation Division coming over, I'd like to wait until they're here and give you a more detailed explanation of that.
Is there communication between the OSHA folks and the workers' comp folks? Because I'm assuming if...
On return-to-work issues, no. OSHA is not involved in the return-to-work issues, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so what happens if I'm an injured worker, injured at work, and I report? Tell me the connection to OSHA. Is there any type of collaboration to make sure that incident doesn't occur again?
Well, Mr. Chair, that claim is reported, yes, and we do one of the data sources for our OSHA work is the reports of disabling claims that we get through the workers' compensation system. One of the ways we handle data, actually, is the data that is received through the workers' compensation system is used by Oregon OSHA and by a number of our other programs to make sure that we are, in fact, able to focus on high-hazard areas. I mentioned earlier that OSHA inspections, whether a business is inspected, depends on a number of factors. One of them is the experience of that particular business And another is the experience of that industry in which that business is. And a lot of that data is, in fact, gathered from the reports of claims.
How many OSHA inspectors do we have?
80, Mr. Chair.
And on average, how many OSHA inspections do they conduct in a biennial?
Mr. Chair, 5,000.
So 80 do 5,000. Okay, that's perfect. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, back on the return to work issues, although we are waiting for the workers' comp, I do want to make clear that there are programs which involve the employer at injury, so that the employer, if someone is able to return to their employment at injury, the employer has certain obligations to get that employee back to work. There are other programs which are aimed at placing that employee in a different position with a different employer, and those are the ones that essentially create a package of benefits for that worker to carry around. How do we actually get the worker back to work, I'd like to defer till I have the right staff in the room.
I want to delve a little bit into the budget issue of back on OSHA. We've got 5,000 cases. Is that a biennium?
Mr. Chair, that's a year.
Okay, so you take 5,000 divided by 12. Divided by 12 equals 416 divided by 80. So they're doing about 5.2 inspections a month.
Oh, I see. If that's what the math works out to be. Some of these inspections, Mr. Chair, are very, very complicated. In a big firm, sometimes it'll take them a week just on site. If it's a health inspection, sometimes it takes them even longer than that because they set up monitoring equipment and then they go back and get the results of the monitoring. Some of our inspections you can do one or two a day, but some of them take a very long time. And then for each inspection, they go back to the office and they write up a fairly detailed inspection report, both finding violations and offering solutions in terms of what needs to be done.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to mention, in addition, one of the workers' compensation-related programs that's specifically related to the issues faced by small business. As I believe you are aware, we do have a small business ombudsman in workers' compensation. I've just been joined by John Schiltz, the administrator of the workers' compensation division.
He's breathing
division.
Too hard. Yeah.
He got the message.
This is hard.
Welcome.
And before I turn it over to Mr. Schiltz, that office is specifically responsible for working with small business on a variety of issues, which can include how to get insurance, issues dealing with the correct premium and the classification of workers, and then issues dealing with how to address claims, how to address return to work programs. So in addition to the services provided in the Workers' Compensation Division, the Ombudsman staff is specifically focused on small business. But John, I don't know if I assume you were indeed listening. The chair, we had several questions from the chair and from Representative Richardson.
Representative Richardson.
Hello. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schiltz, administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schiltz, as we are conducting this hearing, I'm going through surveys. And so I'm looking at one that was, I don't see a date of when this took place, but it's behind tab 21, and it's an Internet Survey Engine Claims Examiner Survey, and it was responded to primarily by employees of insurance companies, primarily those in the classification of claims examiners and adjusters. And so their primary job is dealing with claims that are disabling in nature. So, I mean, we're kind of seeing who the respondents are. And then the information that they provide to us is, you know, how they like dealing with the department. A couple of the questions. One deals with workers' claims histories, and it says, how satisfied are you with these services, especially regarding workers' claims histories, claims indexes, and it's totally very satisfied or satisfied, but would you mind defining what are they referring to?
Thank you for the question. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, they're referring to the workers' history of workers' compensation claims, essentially, in all of those regards. Under the law, the insurance company where the claim is filed, as well as a few other individuals, have the right to take a look at those histories. And they're primarily trying to determine whether or not the claimed condition or claimed injury has previously been claimed by the worker.
Okay. Can I follow up?
Please.
A couple questions later, it says, how satisfied are you with claims file requests? By the way, they're very satisfied. What is a claims file request by an adjuster from the department?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it's a request from the insurance company or the particular adjuster or examiner at the insurance company to obtain the actual file that we have on the worker. We maintain, typically they're very small files on the worker. It's typically material that we have received from the insurance company themselves, which would lead one to wonder, why do they need to ask us for it? For a long time, until very recently actually, the department was the custodian of the record. And insurance companies did not maintain their own claim file records for very long. A few years back, we required the insurance companies to become the custodians of the record. But unfortunately, there's quite a history of claims there, so we'll probably be getting a lot of those claim file requests for some time to come as we go through that transition period.
Okay, follow up. Lynn, if you have compiled a history of a worker's injuries, and then there's an insurance company adjust a request for that, do you also send a copy of that to the insured so that he would know what has been compiled against him or about him?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'd like to try to clarify. Are you asking if we send a copy to the worker as well?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Not unless it's requested. The claim file requests that we get are significant. It's a significant number. And again, it's typically the insurer is trying to just determine, has this condition ever been claimed before for another insurance company? They're trying to determine, are they the responsible insurer for this? On the other hand, the worker, if they're represented by an attorney, which they sometimes are, the attorney will typically request the record, and we provide that to the attorney. If the worker requests the record, we certainly will provide that to the worker.
Just kind of a follow-up. I'm an attorney, but I don't do workers' comp cases. But I didn't know that this record even existed. And there has been one instance several years ago where on a case that wasn't related to, I didn't do comp, but I requested records from the insurance company, and I was astounded that they didn't have those records. They didn't maintain records. And I thought, how in the world could they do that? And you know what? They forgot to mention that they didn't have to, but that they were being maintained by a government agency.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we went through, I think, the same analysis ourselves a few years back. And it was our conclusion at that time that it really was much more cost-effective from the government's perspective to have the insurer become the keeper of the record, and we are now transitioning into that, where they are becoming the custodian of the record. We are withdrawing from that, but we have a significant history of the workers' compensation system here in Oregon, and so it's going to take some time before I think you see the benefits of that transition really occurring.
Just a comment to the committee. You know, my goal, of course, ours is to help assure that the citizens of Oregon are protected, and any time I see something that looks like there is collusion, and I use that word markedly, between insurance companies and government agencies that contain about information that could affect the outcome of a claim by a worker, and the worker doesn't even know that that is taking place, then, you know, it kind of causes my antenna to go up. comment? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I note the comment, and I think that the suggestion behind that would be that you would like us to, at the very least, consider notifying the worker upon sending that claims history to the insurance company.
I would think that would be a good thing to do. I know many hospitals and others that will do that if there's been a request will make that kind of information available, but I think that that would be a fair thing to do so that a worker would know when records are being gathered that he may not even know about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we will certainly take a look at that, and I would like to get back to you with what our analysis shows on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think the whole committee would like to see a copy of that.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to do that.
Perfect. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I believe you had also asked for a sort of what happens to return a worker to work?
I'm injured. What do you do with me? Not you.
Call Dr. Schrader.
Mr. Chair, it basically goes through three steps, and sometimes more, but predominantly three steps. The first is what's known as early return to work, and that's an effort that's made shortly after the injury, sometimes within hours, frankly, of the injury, to try to determine what the worker's physical capacities are and to design a job that fits within the worker's physical capacities. To place the worker back with the employer at injury in a productive role that's within their physical capacities. That may sound like a fairly straightforward and simple thing to do, but it wasn't so long ago in Oregon where that was much more the exception than the rule. The success of that is phenomenal. We have been able to do research on this, and we know that workers who are placed back with the employer at injury shortly.
Give us specifics. Do you go meet with the business owner and try and work through a scenario to get me back to work? How do you do it?
Representative Smith, this program is called the Employer at Injury Program, and it is administered by the insurance companies. We help in terms of determining the program parameters, and then, and I think you heard before from Corey, managing the reimbursement for the cost. But essentially what the insurance company representative will do, will go out and meet with the company beforehand and talk generally about the concept of return to work and help the employer develop a return to work program that is very congruent with their human resources policies and procedures. The idea is let's treat these employees as valuable resources and get them back to work as quickly as possible. It's a win-win for everyone concerned. Specifically, if a worker has, let's say, a lower extremity injury, if you've been in the business for any period of time, workers' compensation, you can pretty well know what sort of work or what sort of physical capacity restrictions the physician is going to apply to that worker versus a back injury or an upper extremity injury. And you begin designing with the employer an appropriate modified job to put the worker back to work. It's sometimes called light duty.
And is that's the insurance company then that
Yes.
works with the employer?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it is. They administer that program. And there are benefits that are provided through the employer at injury program to defray the cost to the employer of this light duty program.
Thank you.
Talk about the other two programs.
The second program is the preferred worker program. The preferred worker program is offered to workers who have a permanent disability. The preferred worker program is very much like the employer at injury program, though it occurs a little later in the process. And that program offers larger benefits to employers to bring either their employee back to work or to hire an employee who is a preferred worker and provide a regular full-time, well, usually full-time, just a regular employment for that employee that meets with their physical capacities. Sometimes that requires significant worksite modification, which we have staff on hand who will come out and help the employer determine what sort of worksite modifications are appropriate for the employer.
Is that paid for by the insurer?
Mr. Chair, that program is funded through the Worker Benefit Fund. The third program is the more traditional program that you often see in other states
or through the state federal vocational rehabilitation program, and very similar to that, it is a retraining program. That's for workers who do not have the skills, knowledge, or ability to perform any job within their physical capacities that will pay them any more than 80, or excuse me, any, they must meet an 80% threshold at their wage at injury to be eligible for that program. So if they can earn more than 80% of their wage at injury, they're ineligible for that retraining. That program is paid for by the insurer, and that program is administered by the insurer with oversight by our division.
Those sounds like really good programs. How do employers know about them?
Mr. Chair, we spend quite a bit of time through several mechanisms trying to get the word out to employers. We have an internet site. We go to just about every single seminar that's put on for employers, the small business fairs that we do twice a year, really focus in on these return to work programs. There's a number of ways. We work through the employment service to get the word out. These programs are very well utilized. The employer injury program itself, typically we've got over 10,000 placements a year in that program alone.
So one of the common themes I find is I think you folks do a very good job, but I struggle with the fact that you're able to disseminate what you do around the state. This will be the last time I ask the question of all of you, but somehow there's got to be a mechanism to help you folks saturate, if you will, the message of what good services you provide. And as a person who works with a lot of small business owners, I knew about one of those four.
And, Mr. Chair, it's always our goal to get the word out, because we can't provide a service unless someone knows that the service is there. So that's certainly something that we put energy into, but until every employer in Oregon knows about what we can offer, then there's still room for improvement. You had asked earlier about how do we get the word out with respect to Oregon OSHA. One thing I forgot to mention is we actually do an annual mailing to all employers about workers' compensation rates. That's something we're required to do, so every employer in the state of Oregon is going to hear from us by mail once a year. And what we took the opportunity to do this past year is that communication is one sheet of paper. And we figured that without an increase in postage or handling, we could actually have a second sheet. And we used that second sheet to talk about Oregon OSHA and about safety, and in particular about our Safe Jobs Smart Business Initiative, which is aimed at small employers and employers who are expanding their workforce. Told them how to get, here's a phone number, here's some resources, here's three things to do, here's our website, just as one more way to try to actually get in the hands of the whoever's in charge of workers' comp and OSHA at every employer. But there's no question there's more we can do.
Yeah, I think part of the struggle, and we've had this conversation, is part of the struggle is a lot of business owners, when they receive that, it's one more piece of mail.
Absolutely.
Until an OSHA issue occurs, or until the premium arrives, or on a worker's your comp insurance, you don't think about it. Anyway,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Richards.
On that note, I can wait.
Oh.
I was just going to say, before we move off workers' compensation, I did want to just briefly mention, although I'm not expecting to spend a lot of time on them, a couple of other workers' compensation-related programs that you're aware of in our department. I wasn't planning to talk about the Workers' Compensation Board at any length because we have covered it before, but one question that did come up is the relationship between our administrative hearings at the Workers' Compensation Board, our alternative dispute resolution process within the Workers' Compensation Division, and whether there was any efficiency that might be gained through looking at the Employment Department Office of Administrative Hearings. And we did, at your request, sit down and talk to Representative Avakian about that issue. I think the conclusion is that this is a specialized area, and please correct me if I misspeak, Representative Avakian, but that we are getting fair amount of efficiency at the workers' comp board, and that the alternative dispute resolution work done at the division is probably the most effective low-cost way of delivering those services. So I did want to report back on that.
Discussion on that issue, or is it the
subcommittee? This session, actually, we have a bill which has been positively received to move. Right now, there are some hearings which are actually split between the Workers' Comp Board and the Office of Administrative Hearings for a variety of reasons. And nobody likes that. And so those specific small group of hearings are actually being moved over to the board jurisdictionally through a bill that we have this session. I also wanted to mention the office, the Injured Workers Ombudsman Office. We had a request during our last appearance in front of this committee for some additional information about that office and their workload. We've provided that. You will see it in your new materials in tab H. We've just gone through and given you some detail about who we serve in that office, their volume of calls. There's 8 FTE there. They deal with during the last 2 years about 27,000 inquiries, primarily from injured workers, and we've given you a breakdown on the second page of the types of issues that they deal with. It is a fairly heavy workload, and it covers everything from simple information to more involved work on a particular case.
So who serve? I'm looking again at this, and I'm looking at the Ombudsman for Injured Workers. One of the issues we raised in round one was looking at creating ombudsman for business owners. How does that work?
Mr. Chair, there is a small business ombudsman's office as well for workers' compensation issues. That office has 2 FTE, and they spend a lot of time doing outreach and also are regularly contacted by businesses with questions about what are my options for getting workers' compensation insurance. How should my payroll be classified? Is this premium correct?
Are they knowledgeable on OSHA issues?
No, these are workers' compensation issues primarily, not safety issues.
Right. Where I'm going, though, is I assume if there's an issue with OSHA, there's also perhaps an injury involved?
Primarily with Oregon OSHA, I mean, there's certainly, if we're in a situation where there's an injury involved, then the workers' compensation system is involved. A great deal of our work with Oregon OSHA is aimed at creating a culture of safety to prevent those injuries. So many, many of our contacts with businesses, including small businesses, in the Oregon OSHA context is not as a result of an injury.
But who's the advocate for business with OSHA? OSHA comes in, can't find resolution.
Well, Mr. Chair, when you say can't find resolution, again, many of our services are voluntary services. Training, consultation, those are not adversary services. We're there to help the business learn about safety and comply. Now, there are situations where we do an inspection and we find a violation, not an injury, but a violation of safety regulations. In those cases also, we try not to treat it as an adversarial system. We work with the business on correcting the situation, and in many cases, there will not be a fine if the situation is corrected. There are certainly situations in which there is a citation and the business wants to appeal. They can do a formal appeal through the administrative appeals process, but they also have the option of an alternative dispute resolution process, which is run through a separate unit at Oregon OSHA and which is very successful in reaching resolution of these issues that's satisfactory to all parties.
So if I'm a business owner, the best thing I can do is just go hire myself an attorney?
Mr. Chair, it's very rare that a business has any need for an attorney or feels the need for it unless it's a very serious situation. Again, what we try to do, Mr. Chair, is work with the business with the goal of achieving safety. Our fines, when we do issue fines, tend to be small and they tend to be safety-oriented. And often, for example, if a business can come in and give us examples of safety improvements that it has made, part of the fine will be reduced to offset that.
Yeah.
Thank
Mr.
Chair, anything to add there?
Pete DeLuca, Oregon OSHA. Just to expand on that a tiny bit, every time we issue a citation, we have what is called a closing conference with the employer, in which the the inspector sits down with the employer and explains to them some of their rights. One of their rights, everybody has a right to go to an informal conference with a person who does alternative dispute resolution from Oregon OSHA, and they don't need an attorney. And all they have to do is write us a letter that says, I would like an informal conference. I don't agree with this citation. It's not a formal process at all. You just, if you wrote us a letter and said two words, I appeal, you've got your informal conference. And then our appeals specialist is trained to sit down with that business owner and talk through the thing and try to find a resolution. Oftentimes it results in a reduction. If the business owner disagrees that he shouldn't have been cited and the appeal specialist agrees with the business owner, then it will result in tossing the citation out. But these conferences are strictly informal. You don't need a lawyer. In fact, I think personally, and I hesitate to mention this, I am a lawyer. I traded my legal robes for the mantle of bureaucracy and hopes that something good would happen. But
I'm here to share with the committee.
The bottom line is,
the survey backs up what you're saying.
Yeah, if we have lawyers in this process, sometimes they complicate it. So for small business to come forward and have a conversation. Well, I'm sorry. It's the truth. And I are one too,
Mr. Chair, on cross examination.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. DeLuca. Who typically would be at an informal conference? If I'm the small business owner and I open the door, who's there around the table?
Typically, it would be the appeal specialist. Probably the compliance officer who was on site, but maybe not, and then you.
Good.
It's a very small and informal process, and they just sit down and talk about it. No rules.
Mr. Chair, when I started at this department, one of the things I did was I tried to get familiar with a fair amount of what we did, and I sat in on one of these. I wasn't introduced as the new director or anything. I was just another staff person. And it was actually fascinating. It was a small business owner, and there was an issue about a forklift and an operator not being trained, which is a potentially highly hazardous situation. And it was just fascinating to me to listen to that small business owner's approach. They did ask for a reduction in the fine, which they got. They brought in all the things that they'd done to improve training and the booklet that they'd now started having their safety committee meetings. And I've never heard somebody say thank you so many times in a row. What that small business owner said is, I want my business to be safe. You've really helped. And it was extremely impressive to me, actually, sitting in on this. It was one picked at random. At least they swore it was picked at random. And I was frankly very impressed with how it was, in fact, carrying out what we're trying to do.
Mr. Chair, just one statistic on this. Of all the appeals that we have, all of them run through this process, or at least have the opportunity to run through this process. And the only ones that don't are people who say, no, I want to go directly to a formal. That happens very, very rarely. But of the ones that run through this process, 85% are resolved in the process and don't go any further.
Perfect. That's great.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move on to another topic area, if I might, unless there are questions.
I think we have a worker comp question. We're gonna
before we leave it, and before Mr. Childs were to leave, Schultz.
Yes, he doesn't get to leave.
Schultz.
Mr. Schultz.
Okay, thank you. I want to pursue this only because I have such great respect for the department, and yet there's this one area that I get complaints on and that I hear about, and it's an ongoing thing, and I think that you're dealing with it from looking at the surveys, but it needs to be addressed. And that is the relationship between a worker and the independent medical examinations that he might receive in the course of the processing of his claim. And so I would like to just briefly read you a couple of things that I see here and then have you respond. There's a survey of claimant attorneys, and it says, generally, how would you rate your client's experience with IMEs? poor is 74%. How adequately do insurers prepare workers to as to what to expect in an IME? And that is, it's not an insurance medical exam, it's an independent medical exam, right? And that's correct.
Mr. Chair, the terminology actually gets a fair amount of debate, but yes.
Okay. Anyway, it says not at all adequately, 81%. And then I skip over to a survey of, I think it's the injured workers, and they were asked what kind of experience they had. Because, and this is good kind of performance measurement, because you're asking the clients and the people that you work with how they felt about it. You know, you're not counting how many hits on the internet or something like that. And so you're asking the right questions. And so one of the questions was, did the insurer explain to you what to expect at the insurer's medical examination? And almost 60% said no. And then how well did your doctor listen to your concerns? It looks like 60 or 70% say dissatisfied or very dissatisfied. The doctor was knowledgeable about your condition. It looks like, again, 60 to 70% say dissatisfied or very dissatisfied. Overall experience with the insurer's medical examination, it looks like 75% or so were dissatisfied or very dissatisfied. And I'm going to get to the point of this in just a second, because they also, you did a survey with the doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the doctors that performed the independent medical examinations. And they were asked about, you know, how well the patients understood it, and they uniformly, the majority say they didn't understand it very well. But then it says, do you consult with the claims examiner prior to drafting your IME report? And often or seldom was the majority of the response, which means that they are talking, the independent medical examination physician, I assume they're doctors, is talking to the claims adjuster before they complete the report. And then the next question is, how has an insurer representative ever attempted to influence your report? And more than 25% of them say yes. So, if, you know, and like I say, I don't represent these folks except that I've been elected by them, right? And so how do you respond to this, and what's being done about it?
Representative Richardson, I'm very glad you asked all of those questions, because that issue has gotten a great deal of attention, both during the interim and during this session and through the Management Labor Advisory Committee. The answer is Senate Bill 311, and it is a major piece of work dealing with this issue because of exactly the data that you have just reported. We had been hearing concerns expressed about the IME system for quite some time, and our response was, we need data, and we now have data. And through the Management Labor Advisory Committee and a lot of stakeholder work, we also have a bill. The bill has passed out of Senate Commerce Committee and actually is in Ways and Means at the moment, because it does have a fiscal impact statement. And I'm going to ask John to just briefly touch on the high points of the bill. Briefly.
The bill really does zero in on the issues that were brought forward in the survey. The survey was part of the process of getting this in front of people, as well as the Senate Interim General Government Committee meetings, where there was quite a bit of testimony as well. The bill is going to give the department the ability to maintain a list, as well as determine who can be on the list and who will be off the list of physicians who will conduct independent medical examinations. It provides for a process of appeal for anybody who gets booted off. It provides the department with the authority to promulgate rules regarding educating adjusters, examiners, as well as working with the independent medical examination organizations which are out there to educate their physicians that are working for them about what is appropriate behavior. There is a connection with the Board of Medical Examiners in the bill for referrals of complaints to the Board of Medical Examiners from IME experiences. And that's just off the top of my head some of the components of the bill. The one thing that I don't think that the bill did that some of the original conception was to turn over actual selection of the IME to the department. There was quite a bit of concern about that, so that's not in the bill. One other thing I should mention, there was also a large concern about travel distance. that 21% of the workers were, and these are injured workers, most of them with back injuries, frankly, who were being asked to travel 100 miles or more one way to this independent medical examination. The workers will now have the ability to appeal the reasonableness of the travel, and they appeal it to us, and we will make the decision as to what the reasonableness of that travel is and determine whether or not that worker has to attend that examination or another examination needs to be scheduled closer to the worker's home.
Under the bill, who continues to pay the fee of the physician, and do you have an opinion as to how that relates to their independent status?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, the insurance companies pay the fee of the independent medical examiners, and my opinion is probably less compelling than the opinions of the independent medical examiners themselves, in which in our survey, 53% of those examiners indicated they felt that there was some degree of bias for the insurance companies by those physicians themselves. They self-reported that.
I'm curious about the maintenance of a list. I was having the same conversation in a totally different context about having a list of consultants who had successfully worked wetland issues through the department. And I was told that such a list was not achievable, simply because of the obvious reasons. You create a list, there's the potential that others could be excluded from the list. So how are you able to maintain such a registry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'm sure Mr. Schiltz will correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is a certification process so that a physician who meets the criteria can be certified, just as with our other licensing program, but they do have to meet the criteria, and then there is a process for removing individuals from decertifying if they fail to meet appropriate standards and dealing with complaints. So it would not be a limited list except by the criteria for being on the list.
Thank you. That's helpful. But remind me then, who would actually say that physician X no longer met the certification requirements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it can happen in one of two ways. If the licensing board of the physician, and you, and it's important to note that, that many of these physicians are not MDs, okay, so you've got multiple licensing boards that you're dealing with. If the licensing board adopts standards specific to independent medical examinations, those standards will be in place, and that licensing board will determine if a violation has occurred of their standards. If they determine a violation has occurred, then it falls to us to determine whether or not the examiner remains on the list or not. The second level would be if the licensing board does not adopt standards specific to the conducting IMEs, then we will adopt the American Board of Independent Medical Examiner standards, and we will make the decision whether or not violations have occurred.
One more question.
Please follow up.
When you say that they're not necessarily physicians, what subspecialties or what other practice groups are included in the list?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I probably misspoke if I said they're not physicians. Typically, all of these examiners are physicians except for psychologists, but they could be acupuncturists, they could be chiropractors. Frankly, there's a lot of chiropractors who are on IME panels. It could be a naturopath. It could be any. It's predominantly MDs and predominantly orthopedists and neurologists, but you do see other types of physicians on there, as well as a good number of neuropsychologists, especially for head injuries. And they have different licensing boards, and so we wrote it generic to the licensing boards.
Sandra Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a common complaint in the coast areas because you are sending them, or maybe not you, but someone is sending them miles away. They don't always have the transportation. And as you know, when people are injured, they're going through a certain emotional trauma along with their physical injury. And I'm just curious, for instance, let's just use the Coos Bay North Bend area. It's a regional medical center. We have a big hospital. We have a cancer radiation center. And yet we have people that have to go to Eugene and Albany to get their medical treatment, and they complain about it. I'm glad if you're going to change that, but surely there is someone on the South Coast that is capable of doing these medical exams. And not only that, if they didn't like that and they need to go to another doctor, there should be two. So maybe you can explain to me what was the list before the new list.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, the list that existed before this list that's proposed in SB 311 are the lists that insurance companies would have on the independent medical examiners that they would use. So there was typically no oversight of that, no regulatory oversight. In this particular case, in terms of determining whether or not the travel distance is appropriate, it's going to turn on a lot of factors. There, sometimes the only physician with expertise in some very odd conditions may be at OHSU, and that might be the appropriate place for somebody to go. But typically that's going to be quite exceptional. And we expect that most workers are going to be able to find competent physicians to evaluate their conditions near where they live.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very, very difficult area to find the balance between, you know, the labor interests and management interests. But I personally believe that it's a mistake not to put independent in the equation, because while we have all used the word independent medical examiners, that's not the correct label. It's insurers. Medical examiners, which by its very nature does not necessarily, in probably most cases, is objective, but it may not be objective. And I think this issue is, I personally believe it would have been better served by allowing DCBS to select and qualify that panel to take the measure of bias out of the equation. And I'm disappointed that that bill is advancing without that provision.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, as you know, like so many other bills, this one's a product of compromise.
Yes, and I understand that it's very difficult, Mr. Chair, but I think our objective needs to be totally independent. It can bias, and workers have their biases. And management has their biases, and it needs to be objective. But I believe it will be an improvement over where we are today.
Mr. Chair, if I may just comment on that, Senator Morris, as Corey said, this is a compromise. We now do have the OMA's backing as well as the Independent Medical Examination Association's backing for the bill, which was significant. I agree with you on many points that you made, and I would also repeat that I think we are making significant progress on this bill.
Thank you.
Representative Babakian.
I know we're getting far afield from a real ways and means discussion. We almost sound like a substantive committee.
Yeah, we're going to pull it back in a moment.
All right. I ought to know the history behind this, but is the term independent medical exam, does that come from administrative rule, or does it come from statute? It's from statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, independent is mentioned once in the statute. The term insurer medical exam is in administrative rule. A required medical exam is mentioned many places in the statute. So there's, as Corey indicated, a lot of debate over the terminology.
Proceed forward.
Mr. Chair, one final comment on workers' compensation is that we were asked to provide the committee members with assistance on how to respond to constituent concerns or complaints about workers' compensation. And if you look at the tab G in the materials that we provided, the letter of February 3rd, page 2, I think that should be the red tab, although I won't swear to it, what you will see is an outline of how you may want to handle those and what we can do to assist you in resolving constituent concerns about workers' compensation. So we did want to draw your attention to that. I would like to move on to building codes, if I could. As I think you know, the Building Codes Division is responsible for the administration of building codes for residential and commercial construction statewide. Our goals are to ensure safe building construction while supporting a positive business climate. So we adopt and administer uniform statewide building codes. We certify inspectors and licensed construction trade professionals. We provide building code and rule interpretations. We provide dispute resolution and oversight of local government building departments. We take enforcement action in response to license code and permit violations. And in jurisdiction, in statewide programs and in jurisdictions that don't provide their own inspection and permitting services, we are the essentially provider of last resort. One of our major goals in the building codes area has been statewide consistency. Another major goal is a system that's easy to use and efficient. The construction industry, I think people may have seen the reports about growth in jobs in the construction agency. It's a major part of the Oregon economy. And then, of course, every Oregon business that needs a facility or needs changes to their facility depends on the building codes permitting system to get their project done quickly, and that's our job. So the Building Codes Division has spent a lot of time working on streamlining issues. Online licensing and permitting, for example, is one of our the areas that we have been focusing a lot of attention on. We do have minor permits available now for construction work statewide. We have a Portland area pilot program that allows customers to buy permits online and find out about licensing information and compliance activities, code interpretation. We're looking at moving that statewide. I want to point out that these sort of easy ways to do things, reductions in paperwork, simplification of permit processes, availability of online permitting, are actually most useful to small business. A large construction company...
How does a small business owner know if they should have a permit?
We are happy to provide, and we do provide, information about when permits are required, and we actually have some programs with the private industry to, we're out there on the radio, we actually have a PR campaign to inform people about, excuse me?
In Seneca?
I don't know if it's statewide, Mark.
Come on up, Mark.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long. The question is, how do we get information out to Seneca?
I'm in Seneca. I'm in French Glen. I'm in, I don't know, LC.
Well,
you have radio in LC.
There's a couple of ways. Director Streisander talked about our outreach efforts. And just one thing I want to kind of just to give you a caveat. You know, we're an organization that used to provide all the service delivery in the state to an organization that's providing very little of the service delivery in the state, although I do think we have Seneca. But so for the most part, we rely on local governments to get the word out. And when that doesn't work, we work on partnerships with our Permits Protect campaign that the director was talking about, where we're doing radio ads, website outreach, shows, trade fairs, those kinds of things. And you know, there's a variety of sources, and this is kind of a new effort for us over the last couple of years, to be honest with you. So we're in our early stages.
I think
you've done
a good job. I'd like to work with you on the outreach. The governor's going to be in Seneca on Friday. I know Seneca very, very well, and I'm willing to bet a contractor there or an entrepreneur who would want to be a contractor there would not be able to get on the radio to find out. And so I want to make sure that all Oregonians have an opportunity to have access to this information.
Don't disagree.
I think you'll know where Seneca is before this week is over.
I know where Seneca is. Been there many, many times. I've been to the school the governor's going to. He is going to have a fabulous time in Seneca Elementary School. question to Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Long, while you're here, I'm wondering if you could give us an update on the discussion that we had relating to computer techs who were doing very low voltage wiring and being required to hire people who had substantial licenses to do that because of the requirements in the agency.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, as you know, the issue was brought up, I think, over the interim. I contacted our board chair. One thing just for the rest of the committee to know, we set standards and requirements through 7 different advisory boards, and many times it's kind of a dual role we have. Sometimes they have complete authority, sometimes it's a shared authority, sometimes we're independent of that. In electrical, that's set by our electrical board. I contacted my electrical board chair, shared with him my concern over this issue, and they've agreed to go into rulemaking to correct this problem. And frankly, we're discussing with the electrical industry the issue of potential change for next session, dealing with not only the computer cabling, but what we call kind of a technical term, limited energy systems. And when do you need a license, when do you not need a license, and how much experience you need. This particular situation where somebody who's doing computer cabling would need to get HVAC training, heating, ventilation, air conditioning training, and other types of training isn't acceptable to me or to our board chair, and we're going to fix that issue that's in rule. But I'm concerned about the broader issues, and I think you'll see us back next session. This is going to be something I have to get all the stakeholders together on, though.
Okay, just a quick follow-up.
Sure.
Chair Vislong, I think it's excellent that we'll be dealing with the broader picture in 2 years. I'm wondering for computer cablers now that have to go through that or break the law, and they shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't require that of them. Is there an administrative rule fix that could allow somebody who's wiring cables not to have to be subject to that kind of a licensing requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the rule fix isn't done yet, but you know, over the next course of 60 days, I think it would be. So that's what we're doing, and then there's some other options for individuals to kind of get through the system. So
thank you.
That's what our board chair and I think I talked to you about a month or so ago. It's all running together now. But
it is. The reason I bring it up is that was a month ago, and now you give me a date, 60 days. And so it'll be on my calendar in an hour, and 60 days from now, I assume that I will have heard from you, and you'll say it's a done deal, and these guys will be taken care of.
I'll say it's a done deal.
Thank you.
Hopefully he'll be calling you at home.
You hold on.
You know what? It was very close.
I could have, you know.
Very close.
Do you know something we don't?
Why don't we continue forward, Derek?
And Mr. Chair, again, I'm sensitive to the time, so I'm planning to move fairly quickly until you tell me to slow down. I did want to mention, with respect to building codes, a lot of the electronic services that we're trying to offer are really aimed at small businesses, because the large businesses have the staff to go stand in line, to fill out the tons of paperwork. Not that we think that's a good idea. We want to streamline for them, too. But we're, as with some of our other areas, extremely sensitive to making the system work for the guy who's just on his own or maybe has a couple of employers. And so that's a lot of the energy that we've been putting in.
How do you folks work with the Construction Contractors Board? Are they apples and oranges?
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of overlap, and we coordinate with them, but there are a number of businesses who do have to be licensed by both, and that's been a topic of conversation during many legislative sessions.
How would I know that?
If you're in the industry?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I can't tell you off the top of my head. We certainly provide information to anybody who we come in contact with who asks those questions of us about licensing required in the trades, plumbing and electrical. Those are the areas that we regulate. But if someone comes to us and says, does my business have to be licensed, we send them to the Construction Contractors Board. Now, one of the projects we're working on with a number of other agencies, and it's led by the Secretary of State's office, we're involved through a number of our divisions and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, is a combined business registry that will allow a business to register, answer questions about their work, and be told, you need these licenses. Right now, that tool exists today, but it doesn't pinpoint quite that finely. So you go in, you answer the questions, and it will tell you who to call to ask if you need to be licensed. That's not ideal. Ideally, it would actually give you need this and you need that. We're one step short of that, but it will tell you who to call. In addition,
we had a conversation with the Department of Administrative Services this morning. Their technical folks were helping put that all together,
yes.
And they were sharing with us that there's a team, if you will, of folks from around the state who are working together. I assume you folks are part of that.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, yes. Yeah. In addition, we have, and you've seen this before, we've talked about before, our license directory, so that if I am in construction or electrical trades or whatever, now I need to know to go there, but I can go to that website, plug in a keyword, and it will give me all the license types that I might need and help me figure out which ones that I need. So, you know, I can't, there's not a one place to go that will automatically answer everything, but we have, again, tried to make it as user-friendly as possible. If someone doesn't know to ask the question, then it's harder for us. We have to try to push the information to them.
Just really quick, and then let's move on. If I'm a person skilled in a craft but not sure how to go about registering, are the keywords that you type in, are they of such a manner that it's going to get me to the page you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, they should, yes. Each type of license has a narrative description that it includes every way someone might refer to that license that anybody can think of, or at least that's our goal, so that you don't have to know the technical term for the license in order to get there.
I think that's important because we here talk in a different language.
Absolutely.
Than the folks who have a skill and just want to start their small business.
Yeah, and you know, we don't, for example, the technical term for someone with a cosmetologist's license, cosmetologist, well, someone might put in beautician. That's okay. It'll still get you to the cosmetologist license, or it should. That's our goal, because we want to be able to have the information accessible to people in the terms they use, not the terms we use. I do want to mention, because the issue of outreach has come up a lot, as it should, and I know it's an area that you're very interested in the materials that you'll see in your tab H, a couple of those letters dealt with outreach areas, and I'm not going to go through them, but I want to refer you to them so that you'll know where the material is. If you look at the letter of February 7th, you will see at the beginning of that letter, we have been asked specifically about outreach for the Office of Minority, Women, and Emerging Small Business, with the specific focus on outreach to non-English-speaking businesses. So that couple of pages, three or four pages, goes through in some detail the types of outreach that we do in that area. Again, it's specific to that office because that's what we were asked, but it's an example of the type of outreach that we do, again, with the understanding that there's always more to be done. In addition, the February 3rd letter.
I'm going to interrupt you really quick.
Yes, sir.
On the Office of Women, Minority, and Emerging Small Business, I want to give the committee a heads up that we're looking at this agency, the agency within the governor's office, and the agency within economic development, and seeing if bringing them together and strengthening them to have a more pivotal role in helping those targeted groups makes sense. I haven't had a chance to talk with Senator Carter yet, but I have talked with Senator Carter's staff. And if you folks recall, in round one, I kind of chewed on the gentleman behind you.
Ron
and
Lewis.
Part of that was because I didn't know that the agency relating to women, minority, and emerging small business in your department, I had them confused with a different department. And if as somebody who works for small business owners, if someone who's sitting up here with your budget is confused, I can tell you someone on Main Street has no idea. And so I think one of the things I want to work with before we get to round three is making sure at a minimum they're integrated, and we beat those up to make sure that every Oregonian in the state has an opportunity to do business, not only with the state of Oregon, but to do business in the state of Oregon. And so I give the committee a heads up on that. It's coming as to where I'm going to try and go.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Is this information, Corey, disadvantaged business enterprises, and even though in your case it's federal funds, is that information disaggregated at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, this is a combination of the federal program and the state programs.
Mm-hmm.
So the outreach tends to be about the whole program.
Okay.
Because many businesses can benefit from certification under two or three of those programs. So we don't want to differentiate them. We want to tell them that the programs are available and get them in the door, and then we can work with them on which of the certifications will serve their needs. Okay. From a funding structure, they are differentiated.
Okay. Can you can they give me this information that's aggregated in terms of ethnic group?
In terms of ethnic group?
For the record, my name is Raleigh Lewis, and I'm the manager for the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business. Your question again, Senator.
Do you have this information disaggregated any place, or can you tell me, define the minorities in these programs?
The number that are certified?
Right.
We can tell you the number of minority-owned businesses that are certified through us, yes.
Those that have access, for instance, ODOT said they spent $43.2 million, TriMet, Eastman, a million. What group got these contracts?
Senator Smith, Senator Carter, that information is provided by that entity that has that program. Some have them broken down by ethnic groups and gender groups. Others do not. They lump them all together.
If you send a message back the next time they testify before this group and I'm a member of it, I'd like to have disaggregated information.
Senator Smith, Senator Carter, for the program that's operated by the Department of Transportation, that information can be disaggregated.
Okay.
However, for the programs that are operated by the City of Portland, Multnomah County, TriMet, Metro, it's based on how they lump all of their data together to determine whether or not they are not meeting their aspirational goals. And some, again, they do it by specific minority groups broken down by African American, Asian, Hispanic, and others lump all minority groups together as one category.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, why don't we see what data we do have that's disaggregated, provide it to you, and then we can see where the gaps are.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
I'm going to ask one other question while we have you up here. I'm going to ask you, Madam Director, and your staff to do a little homework for me. I want to know everyone out there that's funded by the state who is what state-assisted programs we have to help women, minorities, and emerging small business. I've come up with three. I know we had some commissions that were zero-funded. I want to know who's out there.
Mr. Chair, we will see what we are able to find and who might be able to provide any additional information.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I was asking this, Director Streisinger, is because let's take the chair's community. Let's take some of the smaller communities where there are high concentration of Hispanics in those communities. Let's say that ODOT, let's say TriMet with a statewide budget, because we give money for public transportation. Let's say that they're given state dollars, and you have a large Hispanic community in downstate, but all the money is dealt with Hispanics in Portland or African Americans in Northeast Portland. And that doesn't reflect the state support for ethnic minorities across the state. And I think that's what the chair is trying to get to. And I'm glad to see him doing this because I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm glad to see the next generation come along and ask some of the same questions that I've been asking, because too many Oregonians have been left out of the scheme of economic enterprise and development in this state. And that's why my question.
So long as I have the gavel, that's where we're heading.
We will certainly see what information we can collect.
They get it out of my hand, that's where we're going. So, thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could just spend the few remaining minutes on insurance. We haven't talked about the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. They have the largest part of the fee bill, so it might be most useful to touch on those programs on Thursday when the fee bill is before you. With respect to insurance, as you know, our goals are to ensure the financial soundness of insurers, the availability and affordability of insurance, and the fair treatment of the insurance-buying public. We spent some time talking about these programs in our previous appearances. I did want to mention that the insurance buying public includes businesses. Often we think of consumers in the insurance world as being individuals, and indeed protection of individuals is a great concern of ours, but actually a substantial amount of our work is also directed toward protecting the insurance buying, the commercial insurance buyers. And I wanted to mention a couple of small business related programs because that is one of our themes for today. In the health insurance area, it's not widely known that our regulatory structure is actually different for small employer groups than for large groups. A large employer is presumed to have bargaining power, and we don't really regulate heavily the structure of how that insurance product, health insurance product, has to be offered. But for a small employer, it can be quite a challenge, because if you're a small employer and you have, say, 3 employees, 5 employees, and a couple of them have serious health conditions, that employer, without the laws that we have in place, might well be unable to provide health insurance. Our laws, in fact, protect those small employers by prohibiting the health characteristics of the individual employees from being taken into account in offering the insurance and pricing the insurance. An insurer who's in this market has to offer a product to all small employers that's a basic insurance product, the cost of which can be based on the age of the employees but not the health condition of the employees. So in essence, all the employees of small employers are pooled together for insurance buying purposes. So that's one of the protections, actually, that we offer for small employers. Now, small employers certainly have problems obtaining health insurance. One of the projects we worked on this past session with the Insurance Pool Governing Board and Senator Verger was to put together an alternative plan for small businesses that's just getting underway now, so we don't have results yet on how effective that's going to be in giving small employers some alternatives, but it is something certainly that we're continuing to follow. In addition, in the property and casualty area, we tend to have, again, our consumer advocates who work with people in solving insurance problems. They deal with individuals. They also deal with businesses, and a number of our successes in obtaining relief are in the business area. So, again, that's something that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about in the insurance area, but it is a focus of ours. In fact, I think my annual numbers are that about 500 complaints and 2,000 inquiries every year come from commercial policyholders. We talked a little about the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is another one of our insurance programs, during the Satish's introduction, so I'm not planning to discuss that further. And, you know, I feel like I'm sort of racing through this material. We have talked briefly about the Office of Minority, Emerging, and Women-Owned Small Businesses. I'm going to leave the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities for Thursday if I can, but I wanted to very briefly mention the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Again, I think that you're generally familiar with the office.
You better bring him up. I've got a lot of tough questions.
And the timing is good.
Teasing. How you doing, Pat? Mr. Nimble.
But again, Mr. Chair, we've talked about a couple of the projects, the business registry and license directory. Some of the other ones you're familiar with, the convenience store project, where we're trying to get a large number of licenses reduced down to a few. We're trying to look at how to make the whole process of dealing with government easier for business. And that includes big business, but it also includes small business. And again, that theme that the big business, you know, they might not like it, but they can hire enough staff to get around it. But that's not an option for a small business in dealing with business regulation. So a lot of our focus in this program has been in dealing with small business, and in particular, new business. I think you've heard from us before that one of the things we've learned as we've gotten into this project is that the biggest hurdle for a lot of businesses is that day that they decide to hire their first employee, because a whole bunch of things happen at that point from a regulatory standpoint. We're trying to make it easier. In fact, I should mention one of the things you'll be hearing about a little on Thursday as we get into the fee bill is one alternative option that's available for small businesses who are facing that first employee is to use a worker leasing company. One of the items in our fee bill is a worker leasing fee. This program, we actually, as we were developing our budget, we were proposing to deregulate. as our general philosophy is we don't need to regulate something, let's not. We thought maybe we cannot regulate this area. We got a lot of pushback from the industry and small businesses saying, no, actually, this tool, using the worker leasing companies, is important to us, and having the structure in place that you've got allows us not to have to hassle with workers' compensation insurance and maintaining deposits and figuring out how to do this, that, and the other thing. So this is an area where, sort of to our surprise, we're in here asking for more regulation instead of less, but it's with the ultimate goal of reducing that regulatory burden.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Corey, you are fast. I want to get back to the insurance pool governor, but you are good.
Remember, we have 3 minutes.
You did it.
She could be an auctioneer.
Yeah, I tell you. When you're back at the insurance pool governing board, question number one, can nonprofits be considered small businesses? And if so, would they qualify for insurance possibility? Because most nonprofits don't have insurance for their people.
Right.
And I was wondering, could they pull up in the same way? I should tell you guys, even though I'm dating myself, back in 1985, this is the kind of stuff that we did in trying to get small business opportunity with insurance pooling.
He did that in college?
I love it. See, that's why I love him.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, for general insurance purposes, yes, a nonprofit can be a small employer and can qualify, can be treated as a small employer. Now, the specific, the new plans that are being put in place by the insurance pool governing board, and I will confess that the insurance pool governing board is not in my agency.
Okay.
Rocky King wears two hats,
sure,
and half of him is in my agency and half of him isn't, and that's one of life's bits of confusion. So far as I know,
okay,
the small group plans being offered by the insurance pool governing board do not distinguish between nonprofits and for-profits, but I will confirm that and we'll get back to you.
That'll be great, because some people called me about some legislation, and I told them I was going to check, and I forgot until you just brought up the insurance pool governing board, and see if that would be a kind of tip without trying to find some special place for nonprofits to seek insurance opportunity for their workers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, we can also send you the information about that project, which Senator Berger probably has a big stack of in her office, but we'll be happy to send it to you.
Okay.
Senator Berger, you had a question?
I do. I just, Corey, you were kind enough to want to know if I had any concerns about your budget. And before you come back on Thursday, I need to tell you, I don't think I heard much about a worker leasing program as far as fees were concerned, and so if you made the case for that, I missed it, and so that concerns me. And I guess my last thing is, I want you to reassure me that there is a sensitivity in your departments and in your programs of who is paying the bill. I think that you're different than many other of the agencies that we talk to. And I know that at one time people were just wanting to reach into the workers' compensation money and take it that had been paid in by employers, and it seemed to me it lacked a sensitivity. And so in looking at your budget and where your money comes from, I just want to have that reassurance that the people who work in that department appreciate those kinds of fees and licenses that are costing the people to do business on the outside.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, absolutely. With respect to the worker leasing program, you're absolutely right. You have not heard a lot about that. We will be talking about it on Thursday. It is part of the workers' compensation system program, but it is a separate little program which we have not gotten into in any detail yet. Your second point, Senator Verger, we are extremely sensitive to who's paying the bills. And generally speaking, and I think the point was made earlier with respect to how we treat fees generally, we live or die by stakeholder support, and often that means the support of the people paying the fees. And one of the things that we find gratifying but also necessary is that our stakeholders tend to see the value of the services that we provide and see that it is, in fact, important to pay for it. And they tend to support our fees. And we have a public hearing on Thursday, and I'm expecting our stakeholders will be here to give you their own views one way or the other.
Good. Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Corey, when you discuss on Thursday the workers' leasing fees, would you also discuss a sentence that says increases are requested for the following DCBS programs, mortgage broker program, and consumer finance programs?
Yes.
And so,
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there are three elements to our fee bill, and we have that. We have a one-pager. What I'll do is I'll give you just a one-page summary right now. Do we have for the committee members?
Well, we're going to...
But this is for Thursday, but I'll just tell you what they are. In the finance and corporate securities area, mortgage lending and... not included here. Pre-need funeral trusts and... Just those two? Mortgage lending, pre-need funeral trust? Those two? And consumer finance.
Let's do this. We'll address that on Thursday. I truly have to say thank you for the presentation. When there's excellence in presentation, it has to be acknowledged, and I think you've done a very, very good job.
Can I tell you one other
thing? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Yeah. I've got to tell you one other thing, because this department came to my home, my district meeting, where we were talking about predatory lending. And Corey showed up with her staff on Saturday and was very well received and spent almost 3 hours of her time on Saturday with my constituents on this issue. Thank you. Thank you, guys.
I think you folks are doing an excellent job. I truly appreciate your comments regarding small business and the role you're playing in helping small business. I truly appreciate the work you folks are doing in reaching out. And we're going to do everything we can to help you to expand your reaching out, because I think it plays such a vital role, especially noticing that you're doing such a good job.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
With that, unless there's any objection, we will adjourn until Thursday.
And after we have just given you this handout, it looks like the back is...